I got one person's attention there. Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. So far in Numbers, we've found Israel to be faithful. I mean, they've God's told them, you need to leave this way. You need to, unload the tabernacle this way. You need to do this. They've been very faithful in those things. God's not really asked a lot of them up to that point, but they've been faithful. Now, that was not the case in Exodus. They were unfaithful at times. I mean, even as early as the Red Sea, where they went, why didn't you just leave us in Egypt? Bring us out here to die. But in the book that we're studying, they've been faithful up to this point. That changes today. That changes today. We're going to slow down just a little bit. One chapter today will do it. And I don't know, we may keep that up for a little while. But and the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. Man, that sounds a lot like us. Why me? That's the way we're sort of made. The people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. When the Lord heard it, His anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So the name of the place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. The people complained. The people complained. Before we go very far in pointing out Israel's fault, perhaps we should consider how often we complain about the lot that we've been given. Man, I'm telling you, if this social media world we live in has proven anything, it has proven that Christian people love to complain. Because you can't tell much difference between the believers of the world and the world when it comes to complaining. We love to complain. The Lord is displeased with complaining. Clearly He is. We are told in 1 Thessalonians 5:16, I think every Bible translation words it this way because it's just two words, rejoice always. Do we do that? Or are we sometimes caught like the Jews here complaining? I think we all know the answer to that. This angered the Lord when the people complained, didn't it? Now, hang on real quickly right here to what I'm about to say. I have often heard it said that God does not have emotions. I do not agree with that particular statement, but I'm going to clarify what I mean by that. Look, anger is an emotion. Love is an emotion. There's like a 1970s song or something about that. Love is an emotion. That's the truth. God does love people. Hate is an emotion. So it's not theologically correct to say that God does not have emotions. So what do we need to be careful to do? We need to be careful to distinguish between having emotions and being emotional. God is not emotional. Not like we think of emotional. How many people have ever worked with an emotional person? There's one in every workplace. If your workplace doesn't have one, you're that person. Every workplace has one. And everything that happens is the end of the world. Really? It's frustrating, and you're having a meeting, and the emotional person shows up. Why couldn't they skip the meeting or forgot about it, or whatever? Everything is a woe is me type attitude. God is not that. God is very steady. God is consistent every time. God hates sin every single time. God loves His people every single time. God is gracious and loving and merciful and wrathful and all of these things perfectly every time. But all those things are emotions. But God properly distributes those things every time the right way. So let us distinguish between having emotions and being emotional. We, as humans, are emotional. God is not. But God does distribute these feelings that He has the right way. And here, God's anger is kindled when they complain about their misfortunes. Because really, who are they complaining about? They're complaining about God. I mean, when they got to the Red Sea, what did they complain about? They complained, Moses, why'd you lead us out? Well, Moses was God's servant. Moses didn't lead them out. God led them out. They said, why don't you just leave us? Why don't you just leave us there? You know, God's clearly angry because it says so. His fire, it says here, consumed some outlying parts of the camp. And I know, I think that the New King James Version says he consumed some on the outlying parts of the camps. So I spent too much time researching this, but I did research it to see exactly what is said here. There is nothing about some in this passage. There is nothing pointing at people in the Hebrew here. But there is something in the Hebrew pointing to the outlying parts of the camp being burned. Here's the issue with Hebrew. Hebrew is not like Greek. Greek is very thorough. Greek covers every word completely. You know, when you're reading Greek, you hear it is the brother of him. And it's often translated his brother. But every word is there in the Greek. Hebrew is not like that. Hebrew is a very skeletal language. And so there is some bit of, I hesitate to use this terminology, but there is some bit of reading between the lines in Hebrew. Now, when people are translating Hebrew, they often take the Septuagint, which was translated into Greek, which the Lord quoted from two-thirds of the time, and they compare it to the Masoretic text of Hebrew to sort of figure out exactly what's being said. Well, if Jesus quoted from it, it's fine. So it's worth thinking about. Kyle and Delich, who know Hebrew better than any of us, I mean, I can't even tell you a Hebrew letter. It's just pictures. It's like, you know, Chinese or Japanese, you know, like that. They say a literal translation says this, so that the fire of Jehovah burned against them, not necessarily consuming them, and ate at the end of the camp. So God's wrath clearly was poured out on them, the people, but it only ate at the edge of the camp. Now, did God actually consume some people on the edge of the camp? We don't know. But the outlying parts of the camp were burned. And I guarantee you, whether he consumed people or whether he didn't, when fire came down and lit fire to the outside of the camp, terror hit these people. That's the key. Let us not miss the key to the passage. That is the key. The people cried out to Moses. You know, I'm back and forth on if they're right here. I mean, they really should have cried out to the Lord. You know, and I'm sure some guys would preach it that way. And that's worthy of being preached. But Moses stood between them and the Lord a lot throughout this time. God is the man that gave them Moses to stand in between. So they cry out to him and beg him to pray to the Lord for them. So nonetheless, they knew that something needed to be done, and God was the one to fix it. When Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire stopped. And the place was called Taberah, which just means burning. Burning. Here's another passage where I spent a little time studying one particular word. You'll see what it is real quick. Now the rabble, the mixed multitude. I'd never heard this word before this week, but it's so funny. I heard it on a movie this week. I told Wendy yesterday, it's crazy. Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving, and the people of Israel also wept again. They're complaining again. Oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our strength is dried up and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at. More complaints by the people. The rabble had a strong craving. We read in Exodus chapter 12 of a mixed multitude that left with Israel. Chapter 12, verse 38. I know it's often translated the same way here, mixed multitude there, but those are completely different words. They're not the same at all. So translating them the same way is somewhat confusing, really, because you think it's that same mixed multitude, but it's not. I was watching, what was the name of that movie I was watching yesterday morning? Sherlock Holmes. And when they are standing up in the court over there in England trying to get the people to receive the guy who is supposed to be leading them in their eyes, he speaks of all the people who are outside screaming at the building, you know, what they wanted to be done. He calls them the rabble outside. I was like, wow. I can't believe that. I've been studying his word all week, and here a guy uses it in a sentence to help me out, I guess. I don't know. I'm not going to go so far as to say that God ordained me to watch Sherlock Holmes yesterday morning, but it did happen, and I did hear this word properly used. The group in Exodus, the mixed multitude, seems to have been Hebrew people that didn't know which tribe they were from. There had been intermarrying between the tribes. They didn't know. They didn't keep up. They weren't following as they should. They'd been 400 years in Egypt. A lot had happened. They didn't know. The rabble can be defined this way: a tumultuous crowd of vulgar, noisy people. That's exactly what the movie used it as. You know, the tumultuous crowd outside. The mob. Not like the mob, but the mob of people that are outside. A confused, disorderly crowd. Or it can be defined this way: a lower class of people without reverence to an assembly. The dregs of the people. Well, who did the Jews consider to be dregs of the people? Non-Jews. The mixed multitude seems to me to have been Jews who just didn't know exactly which tribe they belonged to over there in Exodus 12:38. Here, the rabble seems to be non-Israelites that followed them out of Egypt. They were convinced that the God of Israel was better than the God of Egypt. I mean, who wouldn't have been convinced that at the Exodus? Now, most of the Egyptians apparently didn't, but there were some that came. They ended up being a hindrance, obviously, here. What about this strong craving that they had? The rabble that was among them had a strong craving. And it was the people of Israel, and the people of Israel also wept again, saying, "Oh, that we had meat to eat." Nothing spiritual here, right? This is nothing but fleshly. Nothing but fleshly. This rabble had wrongly influenced the people of God. What does the Scripture say about bad company? It corrupts what? Good morals. These non-Jews apparently corrupted the people of Israel, because we find the people of Israel crying out. But it's the rabble who is mentioned as the cause of that, and they got the people stirred up. And then they said, "Now our strength is dried up, and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at." Let's read on. Verse 7. "Now the manna was like coriander seed, and its appearance like that of bdellium. The people went about and gathered it and ground it in handmills, or beat it with mortars and boiled it in pots and made cakes of it. And the taste of it was like the taste of cakes baked in oil," or with oil. "When the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell with it." God fed these people every day. And they weren't pleased with it. How about that? We ever that way? Has God fed us? We often spend more time reading other things than this, don't we? Man, I've spent years reading other stuff and not reading that. Papers, whatever. And I'm not knocking them. I got them sitting on my coffee table right now. But my time reading them is a whole lot less than my time reading this book. Because you can read a paper every week, and guess what you're going to believe? What the paper says. After a few years, it's going to convince you. The Bible is right every time. So my time is like 95% Bible and 5% other stuff. We need to be cautious that we're not like these folks and we're not craving something else. God's given us manna to feast on, His Word. By the way, this is the second biblical description of manna. Exodus 16:31 is very similar to this. The "by the way" wasn't directed at that, but was directed at this. Psalm 78:25 calls manna the food of angels. Look at Psalm 78:25. Just start with verse 23. "Yet he commanded the skies above and opened the doors of heaven, and it rained down on them manna to eat, and he gave them the grain of heaven. Man ate the bread of angels. He sent them food in abundance." What about that? They said, "We don't want the bread of angels. We want something else." I don't know about you, but the bread of angels sounds a lot better to me than anything else. But it wasn't enough. When we are not spiritual and we are fleshly, that's when we desire something other than what the Lord has given to us. And that's exactly what we find here with these people. This was all they needed to survive on. Manna gave them everything they needed. At the end of Deuteronomy, when the Lord, through Moses, is talking to the people, what's He telling them? "Man, you've been here in this wilderness 40 years. Your shoes hadn't worn out. Your clothes hadn't worn out. You hadn't had any feet problems. You hadn't had anything." I believe that the manna gave them every bit of sustenance that they needed to survive. Every bit. And it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to them. And apparently from what we've read here in verses 7 through 9, there was even different ways to prepare it. You know, and it just wasn't enough for them. Jesus is all we need. We don't need anything else. He is our manna. In fact, in John 6:35, He calls Himself the bread of life which came down from heaven. I believe the manna pictures Christ. And I believe they're crying out for something else pictures adding to Christ. We don't need to be guilty of that. Verse 10, "Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, 'Why have you dealt ill with your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive all these people, or all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child to the land that you swore to give to their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give all this people? For they weep before me and say, give us meat that we may eat. I am not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you will treat me like this, kill me at once. If I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my wretchedness.'" I'd say Moses is a little depressed. Wouldn't you? I mean, you don't exactly see the normal, faithful Moses at this point. Look, just like we talked about Peter in our Sunday school class this morning, so Moses was a faithful man. He was. You read about the life of Moses, you read about a guy that was faithful. In very difficult situations, Moses was faithful. But here you find Moses, much like we found Peter there that one time. So we find Moses at a weak point here. He's weary of the people. I mean, can't you see why? I mean, 2.5 million or so people here. And he is bearing all of this as they come down upon him and beg for meat. And he says, "I'd rather be dead than with these people." I don't think people really realize the stress associated with leading people. I'm not just talking about in church. I mean it at a job. The stress even that's associated with leading a sports team or whatever. Now, it's all different kinds of stress. But it's stressful. It's stressful. I'm sure that, you know, leading a classroom of students can be stressful sometimes. But leading, period, can be stressful. And Moses had a lot of stress upon him. Despite what Moses is saying here, he was not burying all of these people. Was he really able to? I mean, we have a hard enough time burying our own family, don't we, and taking care of them. But was Moses really taking care of 2.5 or so million people? No. No, but he felt a burden that he didn't feel like he was able to bear. Who was really taking care of these people? God was. But that weight was just on Moses at this particular time in a heavy way. But God aids Moses nonetheless. Verse 16. By the way, this sort of reminds you of when Moses at the burning bush. God says, you're going to go talk to Pharaoh. And Moses said, oh, you got the wrong guy, God. I'm not good at speech. I'm not the guy. And they argue about it back and forth. So, I mean, I don't know another word to use. And finally, God's anger is kindled against Moses, even at the burning bush. And he says, fine, Aaron can be your mouthpiece. What does Aaron end up being? The guy that builds a golden calf. Did they really need Aaron? No, but God gave it to him because he wouldn't be quiet. Sometimes God lets us learn a lesson. Then the Lord said to Moses, gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be elders of the people and officers over them, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their stand there with you. And I will come down and talk with you there. And I will take some of the spirit that is on you and put on them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you may not bear it yourself alone. And say to the people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was better for us in Egypt. Therefore, the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall not eat just one day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but a whole month. Until it comes out at your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, why did we come out of Egypt? But Moses said, the people among whom I am number 600,000 on foot. And you've said, I will give them meat that they may eat a whole month. Shall flocks or herds be slaughtered for them and be enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them and be enough for them? And the Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's hand shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. That's a pretty heavy discussion, I would say, that they had. Despite Moses' complaint, and he was not right, God is the one that saved these people, and God was the one raining manna down. You know, Moses wasn't doing that. Despite his complaint, God graciously helps him. He supplied Moses 70 men to help him, and Moses was the head of those men. That's interesting. We encountered just such a group this morning in our Sunday school class. 70 men, and one was the head of them, the high priest. There is no way for us to know whether this ended up being the same group or not, but the Jews declare to this day that it is the same group. We don't know whether this group died out. We don't know whether this group hung around. We know very little about this group. But the Jews say that the Sanhedrin, which, by the way, means 70, was formed here. If that's true, you can underline if. If that's true, the group here, which was brought about that they did not need at the complaining of Moses, was the group that led in the crucifixion of Christ. If it's true. You say, well, I don't know if that could possibly be true or not. Don't forget, the man that was given to him when he complained at the burning bush was the one who built the golden calf. So God can use it, can he? There's no way for us to know whether this is really the Sanhedrin or not, but the Jews certainly believe that this is where it all began. And they did have a leader over them, just like Moses here was the leader of these 70. God takes some of the spirit that was on Moses and puts it on the 70. God had not asked Moses to do more than he was able to do. By the way, God had given him his spirit to help him. Look at Psalms 106. There's a psalm about this. We're not going to read the whole thing, but I want to read a few verses. Psalm 106 and 13. But they soon forgot his works. They did not wait for his counsel, but they had a wanton craving in the wilderness. That's not like wonton like you eat at the Chinese place. That's like a bad craving. It's spelled with two O's and not an A and an O. Anyway, but they had a wanton craving in the wilderness, and God put God to the test in the wilderness. He gave them what they asked, but sent a wasting disease among them. Should they have asked? They should not. Did God use it? He did. He did. God allowed them to have their way, but not without a cost. There was a cost. How many times has God allowed us to have our stubborn will? And there was a cost. You ever have a time like that? It is so important that we try our best to align our minds and our spirit with the will of God, and even our flesh. I'll say that. And you know, we should be striving to be in accordance to the will of God. Sometimes we preach the sovereignty of God's side so much that we forget the responsibility of man's side. God's will is going to be done. But if that's all I ever say, then you're going to leave here every Sunday believing that you were totally in cahoots with God's will. And that is not always the case. We need to, while we realize God's will ultimately is going to be carried out, we also need to realize that we are often at odds or at variance with the revealed will of God. And sometimes we are praying for things that we do not need. And that's exactly what we find here with these people. In fact, Psalms 106 said just that. They prayed for it, God gave it to them, but not without a cost. You know, what we need to do really, instead of God give me this, needs to be, Lord, you know better than me. Right now I'm wanting this, but you may know better. If it's not for me, please don't give it. If it is, give it. That's the way we need to approach the will of God. We may find a whole lot more satisfaction in our prayer life if we approach things that way. Now Moses seemingly doubts the ability of God. I don't know how else to take this. He seemingly doubts the Lord's ability to feed all of these people. He says, let's see, you know, I'm going to come out of your mouth. People, Moses said, verse 21, the people among whom I number 600,000. We actually know the men numbered about 603,000. I think it was 603,550. That may be wrong. I guess we could go back a few chapters and figure that out. But that's, he's just naming the soldiers here, those equipped for war. He's not naming their wives. He's not naming their children. Most of these people didn't stop at one or two or three. Most of them had quite a few children. And, you know, we don't know the age of all the soldiers, just 20 and up. Some of them may have been 20. Some of them may have been 30 with 14 children. We don't know. But if you just give a man and his wife and two children for $603,000, you come up to about $2.5 million. So $2.5 million is pretty conservative, probably. Moses' complaint or concern here is naturally understandable. Lord, how are you going to give food to 2.5 million people? That doesn't seem realistic. It sounds a lot like, Jesus, how are you going to feed this great multitude with two little fishes? But he did. And they took up, best I can tell, was it 12 baskets full? 7 baskets full? 2 different times, wasn't it? One of them was 12, one of them was 7. How about that? God could do it. Moses understandably doubts. Naturally understandably, I mean. Everything Moses has seen in Egypt, it's hard to doubt. But you know what? He just had a natural response. How is this going to be done? God says, is the Lord's hand shortened? You know what God's declaring? His sovereignty over every situation. My situation, your situation, everybody's situation. God is sovereign over it. I really don't understand people's concern with not wanting to talk about the sovereignty of God, but that is the most comforting thing, to lay down and sleep at night knowing that God is in charge. But if you don't believe God's in charge, then you must believe all the people of the world are in charge. That's pretty scary. Verse 24, so Moses went out, told the people the words of the Lord, gathered the 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around the tent. And then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took some of the spirit that was on him and put it on the 70 elders. As soon as the spirit rested on them, they prophesied. But they did not continue doing it. So this was a one-time thing. It didn't continue. Now 2 men of those 70 remained in the camp, one named Eldad and the other named Medad, and the spirit rested on them. They were among those registered of the 70, but they had not gone out to the tent like they were told to, and so they prophesied in the camp. As the young man ran and told Moses, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the assistant of Moses from his youth, said, my Lord Moses, stop them. But Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, and the Lord would put His Spirit on them. Moses and the elders of Israel returned to the camp. That's a pretty neat passage of Scripture. There was no more power among the people than there was before. If you'll notice, God didn't give them additional Spirit, did He? He took the Spirit that was on Moses, and He gave some of it to the 70. So they had no more power now than they had before. God simply divided the Spirit among them. You say, well, explain that. I can't. I don't have any explanation of that. But I know that's what it says. So we're just going to go with it. 2 of the 70 didn't report to the 10 as they were instructed. Why they didn't report, I don't know. We just know they didn't. We also know this. God knew they didn't report. And God knew who they were. And God had no problem finding them, because the eyes of the Lord are in every place. God's Spirit rested on them where? In the camp where they stayed. What did they do? They prophesied in the camp where they stayed. I assume it was just like the prophecy of these other 68 men. They didn't continue doing it. This wasn't a continual witness. What was the purpose here? To put God's stamp of approval on these men. That's why God gives men extraordinary power. That's why Moses had it. That's why the prophets had it. When the Word of God was being written, they were given extraordinary power. I believe that's why the apostles had extraordinary power. When the Spirit was being given, God said, this is my messenger, hear him. Why do we not see it today? God's not writing the Bible. He's done. That makes a lot of sense. I think it's biblical. Does this then mean that Old Testament people weren't indwelled by the Spirit? I do not believe that's at all what this is talking about. This was a special power that these people had. I believe Old Testament people were in fact indwelled by the Spirit. How else could they believe? The natural man doesn't receive the things of the Spirit of God. So if you remove the Spirit of God from a man, he's just left as a natural man. The natural man does not believe the things of the Spirit of God. What are they? They're foolishness unto him. He can't know them. So I do believe that the Spirit of God indwelt people in the Old Testament, but the Spirit of God was given in a special way to these men, just like it was given in a special way on the day of Pentecost. Completely different kind of indwelling. They were given supernatural ability to do some things that we're not able to do. I know Joshua was loyal to Moses. And that's worthy to be considered. But there does not seem to be a jealous bone in Moses' body, does it? Did you hear what he said there? Verse 29, but Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? And he goes on to say that he would that all the Lord's people were prophets and the Lord would put His Spirit on all of them. And that's how every pastor ought to feel about his flock. And I'm not so worried about me being at the center of attention. Man, I love to see other guys teaching and doing things like that. I love to see people leading. I love to see that. That is part of growth. Moses was a very humble man, as we can see. I think Joshua meant so well here, but I think that we see the humility of Moses as a great example to us. Verse 35, then a wind from the Lord sprang up, and it brought quail from the sea and let them fall beside the camp about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side around the camp about 2 cubits above the ground. That's a lot. Think about this now. You got, and we're probably really conservative in saying there's 2.5 million people. There's probably more. But you got 2.5 million people here, and right outside the camp, God laid down quail for them. A cubit is from here to the end of your finger. Most people believe that it was around 18 inches, their standard cubit. 3 feet deep. Quail. That's a lot. All the way around 2.5 million people. That's a bunch. The people rose that all that day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. Those who gathered least gathered 10 homers. Now, why didn't they gather just enough to eat at that time? Why did they gather all of it? We'll talk about that in just a moment. They spread them out for themselves all around the camp while the meat was yet between their teeth. Before it was consumed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck down the people with a very great plague. What did we hear about in Joshua 1:06? God gave them what they wanted, but there was a cost. Therefore, the name of that place was Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who had the craving. From Kibroth Hattaavah, the people journeyed to Hazeroth, and they remained at Hazeroth. The Lord provided the meat that He had promised. This is an abundance that we cannot comprehend. Enough to feed 2.5 million people. Those that gathered the least gathered 10 homers. The least. A homer is about 6 bushels. 1 homer. This is about 60 bushels. A little better than that. I read that 10 homers actually calculates to about 86 gallons. By the way, why did they gather them all up at once? No cold storage. No freezers. We think, oh, they got enough for 30 days. Great. That's 2015 thinking. They had to cook it. They didn't have any, they couldn't store it any other way. It wasn't like the manna that God was dropping daily for them what they needed. He dropped a month's worth. Now do something with it. So they started gathering and they started cooking. God judged them as unfaithful. They're still unfaithful here. What should they have said? They should have said, "No, Lord. We don't need to meet. We were wrong. We'll take the food of angels." They didn't. They continued right down their path of sin. And when they put it in their mouth, God struck them down with a very great plague. Wouldn't it be better if we rightly judged ourselves? 1 Corinthians 11, 31, 32 says, if you'll judge yourself, you won't be judged. They didn't judge themselves. So what happened? God judged them. We need to learn a lesson. The place was called Kibroth Hattaavah. It just means graves of craving. Wow, Numbers does have some pretty neat stuff in it, doesn't it? Wow, that's in Numbers? Yep. There's a lot of neat stuff in Numbers. We just had to get through the tough part. This is a lot more fun to read and talk about and see. There was a lot in this chapter, actually. A lot to think about and a lot to consider. Hope you had a good day. Hope you learned something somewhere. Whether that be in Sunday school or the worship service or here. I hope you learned something in all of it. But, you know, I hope you learned something. I hope you're better equipped to serve the Lord this week. That's why we come. I ask you to stand, if you will. Colin, dismiss us, please, sir.